Good afternoon, everyone. Today, this is Zoe Million. Today is Sunday, June 29th, and we're doing our teleseminar. We have a couple of people on the line that have some questions, and we're going to go straight to it, okay? So, Nishita, you're on the call, correct?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, perfect. Before I forget, just to let everybody know that the next teleseminar will be on July 20th, before I forget. Also, if ExamPro is reviewing your case list, the deadline for submitting your case list without a late fee is July 6th at midnight Eastern Standard Time. All the details are on the website, okay? As well, an important way to learn how to create a great case list, leading the examiners to kind of ask you questions you want to lead them to ask you. There's the case list construction webcast, which is like a video of the course, so that you could purchase through ExamPro. You can reach out to the office. So those are just two things to let you guys know about. Okay, Nishita, are you ready?
Yes,
for your
I'm
case?
Ready.
All right, perfect. So Nishita actually emailed the office, and this is what she has a question about. So it's a 39-year-old Gravita 3 Para 1 at 35 and 5 7 weeks with an ultrasound finding of an abnormal umbilical cord mass and history of a prior cesarean delivery. Per the MFM recommendations, we were supposed to undergo an induction of labor for suspected mass, and they were okay with a TOLAC. She had an uncomplicated VBAC. The concern that Nishita has is that an unknown umbilical mass could be an omphalocele, but per the MFM, it was a low likelihood, and she was offered a vaginal delivery. What if the oral board examiners ask me why I did not choose a cesarean delivery given this abnormality? So that's your question, correct?
Correct. And it's mainly just like the unknown nature of it. You know, I know omphalocele aren't a contraindication to a vaginal delivery, but a gastroschisis, on the other hand, with exposed intestines may be a little bit more risky. And since it's such a nuanced case, I thought maybe we'd discuss how to defend the decision and
so
the
outcome. So do you know what the final pathology was on the placenta?
Yeah, it was just an abnormal, like, umbilical cord, not a knot, but, like, almost like a aberrant vessels.
Okay, aberrant vessels, okay. So, as what you said, with an omphalocele, you could deliver vaginally, correct?
Correct.
So, in what situations should you not deliver vaginally?
So, from my research and, like, my reading mm-hmm. up on it, like, gastroschisis is one where you could do it, but a lot of mm-hmm. times they need immediate NICU, like, evaluate, like tier mm-hmm. 4 or level 4 mm-hmm. NICU.
Now, do you work in a level 3, level 4 NICU or no?
It was level 4, yeah.
Okay, it's level 4.
So
okay, so you're in the late NICU.
And we had children's on standby for this specific mm-hmm. case, the mm-hmm. Associated Children's Hospital. And then what ended up happening, like the outcomes were great. So there's nothing wrong that happened. And it wasn't actually like a truly umbilical stump mass. Like it was a bit distal from the actual umbilical stump. And so it turned out to be fine. I guess my question is, like, if they ask me on oral boards, like, why the decision to do an induction of labor for this specific abnormality, like that isn't on the ACOG, you know, indicated
right.
induction of labor. It's one of those, well, MFM told me to, so I did.
Right. So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And of course, you mm-hmm. should bring up the shared decision making, because, you know, I just did a quick look at what UpToDate said. Not that I'm not an MFM. I'm not an expert in any way, shape, or form. You deliver under normal obstetrical recommendations, same thing with like regular indications for cesarean delivery versus vaginal delivery. And I'll go into a little bit more detail just on a quick check that I saw. So a question is, why didn't we wait the 2 days and do 39 weeks? That would be a question you could be asked. And at that
exactly.
point, you did a shared decision making with the patient, the MFM, and that's the recommendation is do it vaginal. So that's one question I can ask you. Mm-hmm.
And that's how you would answer it. So if they said, 38 weeks and 2 days, and you wrote that the indication for induction of labor is an abnormal umbilical mass, my response would be, per discussion with maternal fetal medicine and mm-hmm. between shared decision-making with mm-hmm. the family, this was the plan that was come up, like this, that was created.
Right, right. I mean, I guess also you could reach out to the MFM specifically. Why could we not have waited to 39-0?
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, then, so what's a Bishop score? Just ask, you know, just questions off the top of my head. What's a Bishop score? How would you induce somebody who's going for a VBAC versus somebody who's not a VBAC? Because that's a different tackle, correct? What are signs of uterine rupture?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
to my understanding, the bit that I read and up to date, if there was some liver involvement, then that could change things.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the gastroschisis for both of them. So if there is, you know, and I'm assuming that they didn't see any of that because you said it was a low likelihood. So I'm making
correct.
This assumption that the MFM is saying this looks like some odd mass. How much did it measure? Do you recall?
It was 2 by 3 centimeters.
So 2 by 3. They're saying what I found up to date, more than 5 centimeters in size, you know, cephalocele, there's that concern it's going to get trauma in the process of the labor. The same thing with a gastroschisis, if there's any liver involvement, even though there shouldn't be, but if that abdominal wall is exposed. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Also, is there any testing that we can do that will increase the risk of an omphalocele? Like tell us she could have an omphalocele, a gastroschisis, or an abdominal wall defect. A test that you do early mm-hmm. in the pregnancy or in the second trimester.
Outside of the anatomy scan?
Something you could do lab work-wise.
Oh, AFP, right?
AFP, yep. So is there, mm-hmm. you know, the MFM felt comfortable, her AFP was normal, that type of, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, okay.
So, you know, again, we're not MFMs, but I'm assuming that's what they'll say or they'll ask if they even pick the case. Also, mm-hmm. regarding an omphalocele gastroschisis, because they always bring up the gastroschisis, which of the two has the greater risk of, you know, chromosomal anomaly, if they have mm-hmm. a chromosomal anomaly. Because even though she did not have the omphalocele, it could be brought up, correct? Or the gastroschisis, for that matter. Does that make sense? So
yes.
What could be associated, any, you know, syndromes that could be associated with the omphalocele? Usually I believe it's not 13, 18, maybe even 21 could be related. Other questions. So definitely the way you're addressing or looking at your list, because as you're making your list, you should also be looking at what questions can they ask you.
Okay.
Right? And it's all dependent on your presentation. Go ahead.
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but from other colleagues of mine who have passed oral boards, one of the things they say is that sometimes with these more specific cases, it's nice because, yes, it's a very niche topic, but at least you know what to study and what to read about, and you can anticipate questions versus, like, a more broader case might lead you in a more broader direction. Is that correct?
True or false, but on the flip side, would you want to talk about like primary menorrhea and Kallmann syndrome. You know what I'm saying? You feel comfortable. I mean, I've never seen Kallmann syndrome, but you know what I'm saying? So omphalocele, I think it's something that we've all dealt with in some way or another in regards to the AFP being elevated. There was some anomaly in the ultrasound, and then the MFM, you know, chimes in. It's good and bad. That's if they even notice the case. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you wouldn't say omphalocele. You'll say that, you know, the recommendations was induction of labor for a abdominal wall defect. And that, mm-hmm. when you write that down, right, that's when they're going to start asking you all those questions.
Okay.
Right? You're opening the door, so you got to be ahead of the game. It could be omphalocele. It could be gastroschisis. Could there be something else? Those are the big two that we always think about, but is there something else?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there like a Vatter syndrome? Now I'm going into the weeds, stuff I haven't thought about in years. But I think it's a good way of tackling. But then in this type of situation, if you wanted to talk about omphalocele, could you say abdominal wall defect? Unlikely on file a seal / gastroschisis. And right there, you open the door for them possibly to ask you those questions. Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you got to be sometimes careful because sometimes these examiners, they can be a little bit sneaky. So you'll say on file a seal, I'm like, well, I'm not going to talk about on file a seal because they wrote on file a seal. I'm going to talk about gastroschisis.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
They can pull that game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, as another example, let's say we're talking about an office case, okay?
Yeah.
And a patient comes in, she wants contraception, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say she has some weird disorder that has nothing to do with contraception. It was no bearing on the case in any way, shape, or form. Should you include it or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have something weird on your list, they're going to ask you about it, right? If it did not affect, what type of contraception, why would you include it? I'm not saying that I'm not calling this dishonest. I'm just saying this is not it's not something that was relevant. Now, let's say she has
Correct.
A history of migraines with aura. That you should include because as an examiner, I'm like, okay, they're focusing more on LARCs and progestin-only medications, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, in a lot of the office, everybody has a BMI of 40. And it could affect the contraception depending if, the absorption, if you're using the patch and whatever. But then if the patient you have written down, she has a BMI of 40, and you don't mention that you talked about weight loss, healthy eating, you know what I'm saying? It
mm-hmm.
looks like, did you address the patient holistically? Am I making sense? And
yeah.
Her having a BMI
so
of 40 didn't affect her, an IUD, for example. Go ahead.
Right. So if you're going to list a problem, make sure it's addressed in the treatment.
Anything and everything is fair game.
Mm-hmm.
Fair game. Anything. So you want to talk about somebody has hypercholesterolemia? Be ready to discuss it because they can bring it up. Again, if it was something pertinent, like migraines with aura, then you should include it. Am I making sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
They can ask you questions about just statistics in regards to successful VBAC, not successful. If you're in labor, what are the risks, benefits, and how you counsel the patient in regards to TOLAC.
Okay.
I mean, this case alone, for all you know, they'll talk to you more about the TOLAC versus the abdominal wall defect.
Yep.
It's a good case. It's a good case. So
that's
presented. And when in doubt in the exam, via shared decision making, unless something is so odd that, there's no way I would ever do that, then you'd have to say, I referred the patient for a further, for second opinion with a colleague or whatever. Something that's so, I'm going to make this up. The patient has, endometrial cancer and she wants an ablation. Something that's so out of mark. That there's just no way the examiner's going to accept
your decision
that you went ahead and did that. Because you'll have
a
patient, she wants a hysterectomy, and she doesn't want an EMB beforehand. Well, she
mm-hmm.
should have an EMB beforehand, but the patient was aware via shared decision-making that if it is cancerous, she may need another procedure at a later time, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm saying? As long as you involve the patient in the conversation.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's super helpful.
All right. Other questions?
I guess, let's see. So my situation's a bit unique. I'm in urogynecology fellowship. So my GYN, my clinic, my office-based clinic was a bit challenging to get just because I can't use patients that I've operated on. So a lot of mine involve incontinence or interstitial cystitis and not so much bread and butter like contraception counseling or some abnormal uterine bleeding. So should I anticipate that they're still going to ask me questions about those more general GYN topics?
Yes.
Even
Yes, they'll figure out, they'll probably figure out from your list that you're a fellow, and they're going to, they're not going to ask you very specific things in regards to urogynecology, just the pelvic organ prolapse, urinary incontinence, those basics that you would do in office as a generalist. So they could change, if you put your BMI of 40, tell me about the counsel you undertake with this patient in regards to weight loss, or your recommendations.
Okay.
They can just, she's on pelvic organ prolapse category, and they'll ask you something completely different. You least expect it. And that, unfortunately, they'll do more for somebody who has a more specialized list, like somebody who's a fellow like yourself, unfortunately. So you got to be ready for it all. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that I mean, I'm still in the very early stages, obviously, of my studying, and my focus right now has just been on creating my
doing the list.
And exactly.
And the thing is, sometimes that's very important to kind of anticipate the questions the examiners may ask. Just from the, you know, like I said, if you want to talk about infallocele, as per MFM, unlikely infallocele. You know what I'm saying? You could do that. I personally would not want them to do that. I would hope they would not even look at the, just the anterior abdominal defect and leave it at that. But you don't know what, you know, draws their eye.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Questions?
Very good. No worries. Thank you. And if everybody else that's on the call, just jot down just questions that you have, and then we'll talk about them here at the end of the – we have another question. Is Joshua on the line?
Yes, hi.
Hey, Joshua, how you doing? How's it going?
Doing well. How are you?
Okay, perfect, perfect. I'm just going to read the question that you submitted to the office. Okay, so everybody that's on the line, if you have any questions, please write them down, and we'll go into things. I'll open up everything because I can't tell if somebody has a question. I have to open everything up for people to chime in, unfortunately. There's no raise a hand feature. So the question is, I served as a surgical assistant for my senior partner for a hysterectomy. The workup and evaluation in the office was all performed by my partner. I subsequently did the majority of the surgery and wrote the operative note. Do I need to log this case? Any specific reason why you're asking this question? Do you have an issue in regards to the number of cases on your GYN list?
Yeah, no, it's not like the reason for the surgery is fine, but I would have managed it differently. The patient also didn't have a preoperative endometrial biopsy beforehand. I don't know what the counseling was done beforehand. So I essentially met the patient in pre-op as the assistant. And sometimes I double scrub with my partners. Other times I just do it on my own. So this is the case. I'm the junior partner.
So it's not an issue in regards to your numbers. You have enough numbers.
No, I have plenty.
Okay, so for everybody on the call, for your GYN list, you need 20 cases, okay? And only the first two cases in any category count toward those 20. You've got to include all the cases that you got admitted under your name. So the way you, like, divvy them up in the different categories is very important if you're having issues with, you know, the numbers. You don't have that issue, so that's great. But this is for everybody on the call. That minimum of 20 and only the first two in any category count. That's how they force you to get more breath. Let me ask you the next question. Was she admitted under your name or your colleague's?
No, she's under my colleague's name.
Your colleague's name. So officially, so things have changed a little bit in regards to the affidavit process for this year, because previously everybody had to submit an affidavit that was signed by your medical records office. So now, apparently, it's going to be through an auditing process. You do not, this is what I understood from reading the bulletin. If you do not get asked to get audited, you do not have to turn in the affidavit. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Previously, it had to be signed. Everybody had, before you had to turn it in with your case list the affidavit. Now they got to ask you, hey, randomly you've been picked, please, and there's a certain date you must submit the affidavit by. So realistically, you would not go through, it would not appear that you even did this case because it was under your senior partner's name.
Okay. Even though I did write the op note as a favor, just because also my senior partner is like, hey, you need to do more of these cases.
Yeah, to my understanding, it's who the name the patient got admitted under.
Okay.
This is to my understanding. If you have any concerns, reach out to the board directly, and they're very, very nice in answering questions. But that's to my understanding. Things have changed a lot because in previous years, it was, you know, you had your private practice, you took care of all these patients, And it was, they were your patients. Because they've been doing the, you know, this testing since, what, the 80s? That doesn't happen anymore. It's a combined group effort. There's too many patients, you know, patients everywhere. So sometimes you're on and it's your turn to do that case, you know? So that's when you run into that pickle. I would never have, you know, done this case. But then if it's really, again, something so outlandish, then you have to say, I'm not going to do this case. Right?
Yeah.
If you wanted to make sure, and this is what I would recommend everybody on the call, that's what I would do. I would actually go to my medical records department and just touch base with them to make sure things look the same. Am I making sense? Some medical records offices are cool. They're like, yeah, I know you, Josh. I'm good with it. I'll sign whatever. Others are very nitpicky, and they go through every case and are like, yeah, yeah. So if there's any discrepancy and there's any issues, you can get dinged. Am I making sense? So it might behoove everybody to just touch base with your medical staff, hopefully have a good relationship with them. And unfortunately, everything now is done through transcription, through the, you know, EMRs. So you don't have that, you know, the medical records office is just a handful of employees. So you don't have that interaction that you could have had with them 20 years ago. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Things are very, very different. You probably don't even know who works in your medical records office. So maybe just stop by and say, hey, how you doing? I'm Dr. So-and-so in the OB department. I'm coming up for my boards. I know you guys have done it for other docs. I just want to make sure everything looks like we're in agreement just in case I do get audited. And then I have this affidavit and all that stuff. Or can you tell me who I need to talk to? Just, you know, because God forbid something's wrong that you can catch now that, you know. But from what you're presenting, just because you did the op note, it should be who the patient is admitted under. So there might be some issues in OB where a patient got admitted under your name in labor, but you didn't do the delivery.
Yes.
Right? But yet she's your patient, right? Because you did the delivery.
So like in those scenarios, that's like, for instance, like I've admitted hundreds of OB patients, but I'm not going to put hundreds of OB patients on my case list if I just say I admitted the patient and then the patient had a delivery like 2 days later and had a hemorrhage. Like, I wasn't even involved in the
You shouldn't.
The
you shouldn't. Yeah. But the way the medical records does it is who got admitted under your name. So when I went to talk to my medical records office years ago, I had it all lined up to say, you know, I admitted her, but I didn't do her delivery, and they're like, yeah, no worries, we're good, we'll sign the form. I mean, I came prepared just in case there would be stickers about it, and they just signed it, couldn't care less. You know, again, some people are very specific, others, they're like, I trust you, you know. Now, on the flip side, if you're having problems with numbers, then you may have not done the delivery, you may have to include the patient. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Let's say you're a urogynecology fellow and you're having issues trying to get your OB cases in. If she came in under your name, you're going to have to say SVD, you know, by colleague. But then that way there's avenues of questioning in regards to the management of the labor process if you have some issues with your numbers, so to speak.
Okay. Thank you. I had one more question related to this, too.
Sure.
I have a patient of mine, an OB patient of mine, I admitted for a workup for – she had, like, chest pain and calf pain, so I admitted her for – honestly, she shouldn't have been admitted, but the reason why she was admitted was because she was unable to get a lower extremity Doppler overnight, so she had to stay for the next morning. Does that count? Is that something necessary to add onto my case list if the workup was negative and it didn't change the remainder of her obstetric management?
Unfortunately, according to the proper regs of what the bulletin says, she should be admitted because she got admitted under your name and she stayed the 23-hour OBS. But then again, can you reach out? It doesn't look like you have an issue with numbers. Can you reach out to your medical records department and say, I can't comment because you guys have more access to the software. All I see is the bulletin. In the software itself, does it have the affidavit in it? Do you have access to the affidavit you can print out?
No. It just has the entry, like the week that you're assigned to take the exam and then where you can enter your cases. That's all I have available.
It doesn't have the software, because in the older software from last year, the year before, there was the affidavit form that you had to print out.
So if you could have that
in your hot little hand and send it, and just take it to medical records and they could sign it right then and there, you know, if you got audited, you had it right there. But it's to the discretion of the board that they can change the way they do things, right?
Yeah, there does not appear that there's any affidavit. I'm on the software right now, so.
Okay. Yeah, because I had the affidavit, I had to print it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit different back then.
Okay.
So realistically, yes, but that'd be something I would touch base with my medical records office to see if they would include it or not.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
You know,
thank you.
You can actually do something and say, here's a list of the patients that I was responsible for. I wanted to make sure, you know, you're not saying what you did with them or anything. Is this something, I don't know what you guys do on your end to confirm that's the case. Can you just check on it? And then hopefully there's the meeting of the minds and it looks what they have and so on and so forth. And if they say, no, there's, you know, medical record number 22222, this one, yeah, it looks like she got admitted. You don't have her on our list. And again, sometimes these lists are so big, they sign whatever. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what I've seen. But sometimes they get very, 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 very particular. It all depends who's running the medical staff.
No, it makes perfect sense to talk to whoever the person is directly.
Because God forbid
so
you did all this work.
Auditor.
Exactly.
Because
I don't know what the auditing process is now, because in the end, probably we all submitted the affidavit and then on randomly they just looked at things, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
That's what I'm assuming, that, you know, now they're saying what's a little bit too much for us. We'll just do it like, you know, a sampling of it and see if it looks appropriate or not.
All right. Well, thank you. Those were really the specific questions. I appreciate it.
All right. Very good. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. All right, so I'm going to open up, I'm going to unmute everybody, so if everybody can kind of like have that background noise at a minimum to see if anybody has any questions. You just have to chime in because I just can't see if anybody's interested in answering, in having a question answered. If you don't want to speak, just mute yourself. Does anybody have any questions?
I actually have a question. Are you able to hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you. So I have two excisional procedures on my GYN case list, and they both had positive surgical margins. And so I listed it as a complication. And of course, they're like stacked on top of each other, and they're my only leaps. So I was curious, like, am I right, one, in putting that as a complication? Should I leave it there, or does that make it more, I guess, suspicious or open to question?
So why... You know, it's not the best outcome. Would it be better to put in the pathology positive margins and then in the complication, not that it's a complication, but how you followed it up?
Okay. Yeah.
Would that be better?
Yeah. And so I have it in the pathology and then I also listed in the complications. So that's why I felt like I was drawing more attention to it. One of them, she was to being menopausal, and she ended up just going, I sent her to Gen Onc because her ECC was also positive at the, like, with my leap, and so I sent her for a hysterectomy, and the final pass is, you know, nothing invasive.
So in essence, for that particular patient, I would say positive margins, and I'm assuming CIN3, positive ECC, and then I would write in my complications, GYN oncology referral. Again, it's not a complication, but it's like we read left to right. So, she had positive margins, and now the next thing, because that's just instinctive. We go to the next, you know, on the right, and like, oh, she, you know, oncology. And it's great that you know what transpired, because they can ask you, okay, so what happened to this patient?
Got it. And then the other
Did you get a repeat excisional procedure, or they went straight to hysterectomy?
They actually just went straight to hysterectomy. I provided them her path and went straight there. And the other one is a reproductive age. So I offered her, of course, like either repeat procedure or repeat, you know, colposcopy. So since that hasn't happened yet, what would you suggest I put under the?
I would say, you know, repeat, I'm assuming she was greater than 30, you know, co-testing with colposcopy in 6 months, right? Because there's that specific ASCCP algorithm for those women that, you know, they may not want to have an excisional procedure because of concern for, you know, future pregnancy issues. That's what I would follow. I don't know if there's one specifically. Once you have that positive margin, I don't know how positive it was. I would have to look. I would have to put it in the little, you know, app to see what it shows. But I would definitely, you know, I would follow her up with, you know, that co-testing with that definitely colposcopy, ECC, you know.
Okay, thank you. And, of course, I've done my research into, like, figuring out how to defend it, like the depth. I even looked back at, like, the pathology, like how deep was it. They were pretty decent. So I just wanted to know if it would be extra. So I'm going to, yeah, I'll make those adjustments. Thank you,
you know,
so much.
So can I? Was it CIN1, CIN2?
So the reproductive age patient, it was the LEAP specimen was CIN2 to 3, so HPIL with positive margins.
Yeah.
Benign, so that's more reassuring. The other one who was closer to menopause had both HPIL in the positive margins and positive in the ECC.
Okay,
so that, and
so
that's why
more.
It's very deep.
You know, because a lot of the thought process, a lot of times, and I think your management appears appropriate, especially for the reproductive age patient, where, you know, that process of cauterization, when you do the LEAP, it does jumpstart the body to start healing itself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? So, you know, some people say, it depends, I guess, who what expert. Some people are like, yeah, she definitely needs, you know, another excisional procedure. Other people's like, well, let's just monitor. See, the key here is she needs something extra done. She can't be forgotten. We won't see you in a year, right? That's not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know they have that argument that the cautery can possibly, I don't know, like kill any of the. So,
I don't
so
know
done,
if I would feel comfortable if it was a positive ECC to think that way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because that throws it a little bit off a little bit more. But definitely for that reproductive, especially with that ASCCP algorithm, kind of saying that, I mean, I think it definitely supports that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries. Any other questions on that one?
No, thank you.
Okay, good. Okay, very good. Anybody else has a call, has another question on the call?
Hi,
I have
a question about...
There's two more people
that
have questions.
Yep,
there's two people that have questions. Okay, so people can hear. I don't have that much background noise, correct?
Yes.
So I can hear you guys perfect. Okay, go ahead. And then we'll whoever was talking behind you, we'll get them next. Okay?
Okay. I have many cases, let's say in GYN, I have many operative hysteroscopies, but I don't have any non-obstetric dilation and curettage. And I'm over 20 in cases, but kind of closer with decrease the number because there's many cases in one category. If you did a hysteroscopy, would you ever call it a dilation and curettage, like if you weren't taking samples with the hysteroscopy or something?
So you just did a hysteroscopy just to take a look? You didn't do a D&C? Why not?
No, I did do a D&C. So I did a hysteroscopy and then
doesn't matter.
A D&C
if you did, if you did a D&C, you could put it on the hysteroscopy category or D&C, non-obstetric.
Okay.
100%. Yeah.
And then if I had a patient in GYN and also in obstetrics, how do you decide which?
Wherever you need the number. Wherever you need the number. So I'm assuming your GYN has the smaller numbers. I would put it in my GYN.
Right.
And then you need to include that you did the vaginal delivery. As you know, because you can only put the patient on your list once.
Right.
You can only put it once. So you have to decide where you want to put her. So if you need more of the GYN numbers, then you just say SVD, you know, uncomplicated SVD by candidate or whatever. Right. And then go into the, you know, was it a postpartum tubal or whatever? Because you could definitely put a postpartum tubal in your GYN.
Okay.
100%.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Hi. My name is Reynolds. I have a question with regard to post-operative deep tissue infections. So I had two cases. I had a C-section, who was in, you know, active labor. C-section went fine, no issues. Developed a pretty huge abscess right on the front of the uterus. I also had a hysterectomy that developed an abscess right next to the vaginal cuff. In our department, we found that we had a spike and cluster of those deep tissue abscesses across the different surgeons, across the different types of hysterectomies, went back and found out that the vaginal preps were not being done properly.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I called it out on a C-section I just did like 2 days ago. So if either of those cases gets brought up, is there any ability to bring in or productively discuss, hey, we did a root cause analysis type thing on this stuff in addition or apart from the actual workup and management that we did on the individual patients?
100%. I think that's a fact. If you can bring that in, that'd be fabulous, because that's the point of all these root cause analysis. And it wasn't your surgical technique. It was actually something that was hospital-wide, right? And I think the way you presented it was perfect. It's like it was noticed. And this is what the hospitals are supposed to do when they're having these higher numbers than infections. I've heard of cases that a particular room had an improper ventilation, and that's why there was a lot more infections in that room compared to any other room. So those things, that's how you have to discover, because you don't want to have a patient get sick because of something that could have been, you know, corrected. So I think that's what you said was perfectly fine. I mean, I won't let them know ahead of time. I'll let them ask me and say, oh, but by the way, you know, we were noticing just hospital-wide, we were having an increased number of infections, and we discovered the vaginal preps weren't. So that being said, please be well-versed on the different types of vaginal preps.
Okay.
What's the proper way of doing a vaginal prep?
Okay.
Something you never would think, right? You never would think that this could be a factor. It could be, right? And remember, they can ask you questions that they themselves may not know the answer to. You'll never know that, right? So they just want to see how you think on your toes.
Okay.
So I thought your presentation was very, very, very good. Yes.
I appreciate it. And so this is a more general question. So for example, it was AJOG or ACOG, the green journal or the gray journal, recently published some study about, I think it was a meta-analysis, in terms of finding a slightly lower C-section rate on induced TOLAX rather than waiting until, you know, 41 weeks with expectant management. So, I mean, that study came out like less than a month ago, for example. Mm-hmm. Would it be good to include references to that stuff, or would it be better to act like that super recent information doesn't exist when they ask, oh, well, why did you induce the TOLAC?
So are you saying reference in your list itself?
Well, we have lots of TOLACs.
Right, because you can't really write, like just for everybody on the call, you really can't write on your list a reference to a textbook or an article. So please don't do that. Now, that's something they can ask you. But that being said, if you start talking about the data, the literature, those type of things, be ready to be talking about exactly chapter and verse of what you're quoting. And they themselves, if it's an MFM, because they're really brilliant, they'll come up with other things to counteract what you said, right? Because every study, there's a study one way, and then the other study contradicts it, right?
Yeah.
You could say, you know, as you know, my group, this is what we've decided to do.
Okay. All right.
You know, this is what, you know, collegially we've decided from, you know, it's hard. I don't want to say different sources, but as a group, this is what we decided to do, whatever the case may be. And I'm not saying inducing a TOLAC is wrong, but you got to be prepared how you would do it differently than if she was not a TOLAC, correct?
Yeah. Absolutely, and just be able to justify it in a way that
doesn't
make you look like it.
But be careful bringing up any data, literature that can really burn you, because there's always something to refute the other side. right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just everything. Unless it's something that's like everybody knows that, you know, that's the way something should be, right? You don't give Mesoprost or Cytotec to a Tolac to induce them, right? That's understood.
Absolutely.
Yep. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely does. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right,
cool.
No worries. Anybody else have any question? Because we've got 5 more minutes on the call.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question.
Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, so this is regarding office gyn cases. Just in general, I'm a urogynecology fellow, so similarly to another candidate earlier in the call, a lot of my patients come in with like urogyn-specific conditions, but then like I would counsel them like on other things on that list of categories, like wellness, et cetera, and that is something that I'm hoping to like, it's still okay to include, like if they came in with like overactive bladder, but still like I know that there's like dietary changes and like physical activity and all these things that can influence their
symptoms. Yeah, you could definitely put her, you could put her in that wellness category, 100%.
Okay, and do I still include like in the problem section, I put overactive bladder?
Yes. The problem section would be unless you already had diagnosed, because remember, problem is why the patient came in. I don't know if she came in saying I have an overactive bladder unless it was diagnosed previously. She came in with urinary incontinence, BMI of 40. Right?
Okay.
And then and what you do for her. You know, you could have referred her to bariatric surgery, nutritional referral. You know, you talked about, you know, healthy eating, exercise, weight loss. And then in your results section, you could say, you know, follow up, you know, 5-pound weight loss or whatever, you know, shows that she's, you know, actively doing what needs to get done to get better. You know, you could give her the medication, but if she can help herself by losing some weight, that's really going to help, right?
Right. Okay. And you said to include that in the results section, so like how the follow-up was planned.
Follow-up, like, you know, if you started medication for the overactive bladder, did she improve, you know, improvement of symptoms, 5-pound weight loss, if you talked about the wellness. Same thing with, like, smoking.
Okay.
You know, decreased smoking, you know, from, you know, one pack to, you know, decreased smoking to half a pack a day, whatever the case may be. Shows that there is some result.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you so much.
Because I know initially you want to write the results, and that this is my opinion, but I think, you know, when I've done so many caseless reviews, it's hard to flip back from the diagnostic procedure to the results, and it gets very frustrating. As an examiner, I could see it being frustrating. So my recommendation would be to put on the diagnostic procedures, the results of what you ordered, and then the results column is, was she satisfied with her contraception, improvement of symptoms, whatever the case may be. Satisfied with contraception, you know, or whatever the case may be. It shows that what you did for her helped her.
Makes sense.
You hope.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
No worries. All righty. Anybody have any other quick questions? I just want to remind everybody, I know I said
excuse
it.
Excuse me?
Yeah, go ahead.
May I ask one question? Sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Talking about not using patients more than once, so I have a patient on my OB case list who recently was diagnosed with trisomy 21 and ultimately had a termination. But this was also a short interval pregnancy, and she did have a vaginal delivery within the last 12 months. So I wasn't sure how to categorize.
Did you manage her for both times?
I did not perform the termination.
The D&E.
I'm in a restrictive state. Yeah.
Right. But you took care of her.
Yes.
For both. So what I would do,
yes,
it's kind of like if you had a GYN case where she had two procedures, literally I would draw a line. I would present the first vaginal delivery and then draw a line throughout the entire case. And that's going to tell the examiner, okay, we got another thing that happened to this patient. It's a different pregnancy, right? It's a little bit different if it was the same pregnancy. And then I would write short interval pregnancy and then what transpired, a trisomy of whatever, and, you know, referred for termination.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You know, treatment option counseling, you know, that type of stuff. And then she decided to go with the termination. All right, that helped? Yeah, that you do that a lot with the GYNs if you have, like, the hysteroscopic DNC, and then she has a hysterectomy. Some people like putting a number one across the case and then underneath a two, but you got to put it at the eye level. So I think making the line makes it easier.
Do you know what the are we able to put a line in the...
People have told me they've been able to do it. Again, I don't have access to the software, but I have been told you're able to do it because you want to keep everything at an eye level if you can do that.
Okay.
It makes it much easier.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, no worries. And I just want to remind everybody the next teleseminar is on July 20th. As well, if you're doing a case list review through ExamPro, the deadline without a late fee is on July 6th at midnight Eastern Standard Time. The details are on the ExamPro website. As well, there's the case list construction webcast. It's an important way to learn how to kind of create a great case list, often kind of leading that examiner to ask you questions you want to be asked. So you just have to reach out to the office, and it's apparently a video or something you could watch online. Okay? With that, I'm just going to open it up one more time. Any other questions before I let everybody go? No other questions? Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for participating. Good luck with the list. I know it's very stressful, but you're almost down the home stretch. Again, please pay attention to what the bulletin says in regards to when things are due. And what I can't preface, before you submit the send button to the board, please make sure you have the minimum requirements for all three lists. So, you know, because in the editing process, some cases could get moved around. Then all of a sudden you have three cases in a category in the office, and that will preclude that list from being accepted. And if it's not accepted, then you can't sit for the board. So please, I know it's something very trivial, but it's so important, that minimum requirement. Please make sure you have that minimum requirement of what the board is requesting on all three sections before you submit them. I hope everybody has a good rest of their Sunday and a good week coming up. Thank you.